Mr. Stone, income tax rates have come down. Transfer tax rates are coming down. That seems to be bad news for charities. What are you recommending to your charitable clients and to your charitably inclined individual clients to encourage charitable giving?
Dick, I don't represent any charities as clients, although for many years I've regarded myself as a charity, a support organization for my wife and children. But that's not what you're asking. If I did represent those charities, or if I were a true charity myself, I guess I'd be put in a difficult position here. I'd secretly be hoping that Congress, please don't repeal this tax. Congress, please keep the exemption level low. Congress, please keep the tax rates high, because that does encourage charitable giving. But charities can't do that, and they really ought not to be, you know, doing that. They're simply going to have to tread their way through this uncertain time, just like the rest of us are. But I think that charities really, in reality, have a different perspective on tax reform than those of us as planners do. I believe there have been some empirical studies out there that show that a lot of charitable giving is tax motivated, and I can't point to any hard circumstances myself where I can use empirical data, but I also believe that is true. And I do think that charities are going to have a very difficult time if we do have, and I don't think we're going to have it, but if we have very significant estate tax reform or repeal. If the exemption level goes up to $5 million, like Ed says, may be a possibility, and the rates come down to 35% off a 45% rate now, my gut feeling, that's not going to be enough to really hurt charities deep down. It'll affect them somewhat. Shifting the focus to individual clients, I'll have to say I have never recommended charitable giving to clients as an estate planning technique. I discuss charitable planning techniques with clients, but I do not recommend charitable giving. A client either has philanthropic motives or they don't. And if they don't, I would never try to push that type of client into a charitable planning situation. Most of the clients that we have who make charitable gifts, they're fairly straightforward, cut and dried. They make simple outright bequests in their will or in their revocable trust. You know, a gift to their college, a gift to the the charity that came in that treats diseases, you know, of that they've got or that loved ones have. Those are not going to get affected by tax reform. Those gifts are still going to get made. Those are fairly simple, straightforward. The next level up, though, of sophistication is the split interest charitable trust, typically the charitable remainder trust, sometimes a charitable lead trust. And I do believe that those are fundamentally, I'd be interested to hear what Ed and Norm have to say and those of you in the audience, but I believe that those are fundamentally tax-driven by tax motives, or otherwise we wouldn't be complying with all those fairly detailed rules. I do think that those will be adversely affected if we have significant reduction in tax rates and increases in exemption levels. But the third and most significant level of planning that I find with my clients is those who have or who want to form their own private foundations. And I don't think that that's going to be affected by anything that Congress does in the tax laws. I may be a little bit naive when I say that, but clients at a certain threshold of wealth, and you can put your own number that you want to, but I'd say at least $50 million and on up. A lot of them think, in some cases, their clients have enough already. In some cases, they think they've got too much already. And they don't see any need to leave that wealth, just to dump it out, you know, to the little you-know-whats who are never going to appreciate it. And to plan down for two or three, or you go to Delaware, you know, for an infinite number of generations without a rule against perpetuities. They're just not interested in that, and they are interested in the positive benefits that come from leaving assets into a family charitable foundation and having family members participate in that, and that is a way to try to maintain family commonalities among family members over longer-term generations. The last thing that I'll have to say on this is that, and it goes back to the same, that second organ that I used in the last question, the nose and the smell test. You know, you'll see a lot of this coming to you, people that will want to use charitable components to accomplish other non-charitable purposes in planning. And to me, that just automatically flunks the smell test. And to me, some of it gets down into the level of sleaze. And the people that get caught on that deserve to be punished on that. And Congress is obviously tightening up on that. I stay very far away from any of that, and I don't go anywhere close to that.
Well, that's particularly true. And if you had a question, one of the recent changes in the tax law that everybody was worried about, and it does need to be clarified a little bit, was the idea, well, you can't have effectively split interest, fractional interest in tangible property as a charitable gift and not have given it all away before you die. And if you thought that was going to change, there was a thing in Forbes, I think it was 2 months ago, an interview of Grassley, who basically they were asking him about that, and he made it real clear. He says, if you're going to get a deduction for a gift, you ought to give it. I mean, there was no equivocation, and it's none of this that, you know, as you were talking about where they're trying to play games with this stuff. Where I would say, Dick, that you're going to find taxes driving things is if we get away from the 15% capital gain rate, I think you'll see a lot more of the charitable remainder, inter vivos charitable remainder gifts where people can then, you know, keep that extra, whether it's 28% or whatever it is, and allow that to be generating income during their lifetime, maybe even use some of it to the old, I mean, this is more than 20 years ago, the wealth replacement trust for the life insurance and the stuff. I think you'll see that coming back a lot more if the 15% rate goes away.
Mr. Benford, I've seen increasing interest among non-resident aliens in creating trusts in this country. What is driving this interest? Do different considerations apply if an NRA has U.S. beneficiaries or if he or she might emigrate to the U.S.? What features are important to non-resident aliens in selecting a state to house their trusts?
Well, for a myriad of social and political reasons, non-resident aliens, at least in my part of the peninsula, seem to be more eager to create trusts. It may be because they are contemplating immigrating, coming ashore here. It may be they have beneficiaries in the United States that they want to take care of, kids who go to college here and decide to stay here. Legislation in taxation of foreign trusts over the past 10 years or so have encouraged this activity by a non-resident alien in the sense that it allows a non-resident alien to have a trust be administered here in the States, but permit it to still be taxed as a foreign trust simply by giving one or more offshore folks a significant fiduciary power. In terms of the kinds of trusts we're doing for non-resident aliens that are being administered here, there are really two types. One negative factor against non-resident aliens doing this, before I get into the two types of trust, is that some of them are concerned about the U.S. court system and the U.S. reporting system on banks. And they're concerned that if they create their trusts here, that a beneficiary may more likely be able to attack the trust in a U.S. court, which the beneficiary cannot do in a Colombian court since they don't know anything about trusts, or that the bank, other trust institution that is administering the trust, may be forced to disclose certain information about the trust to the non-resident alien's home country. I think you can dispel that, but some of them will not hear of a trust administered in the United States. There are offshore jurisdictions where they feel much safer. The two most common types of non-resident alien created trusts that we deal with are foreign grantor trusts. That is, under the current law, a trust that's either revocable by the non-resident alien or is created for the benefit of the non-resident alien and her spouse. Either of those powers makes the trust a grantor trust. The tax advantages of such a trust is that while the grantor is alive, there's no U.S. tax on trust income, and the U.S. beneficiary can avoid U.S. tax on distributions. The simplest way is the asset being distributed to the non-resident alien grantor and the non-resident alien grantor creating an account offshore for the U.S. beneficiary. After the grantor dies, though, there's an increased body of complex rules that apply to the irrevocable trust, such that you may want to consider at that point moving the trust onshore. The key in doing these trusts is to provide maximum flexibility in the document, maximum flexibility as to the choice of trustees or other fiduciaries like protectors and selectors, flexibility in shifting situs, flexibility in moving trust assets from one trust to another trust in a different jurisdiction, this broad discretionary distribution powers that allow you to distribute outright or in further trust for almost any purpose, and the availability of powers of appointment in the beneficiary's hands. The second class of trust is a non-grantor trust, and the primary benefit of a non-grantor trust, that is, a trust that the non-resident alien can create offshore over which the grantor does not create powers that make, under U.S. law, the trust income taxable to him. The primary benefit of that type of trust is to avoid federal estate taxes on the assets in the trust if, for example, the grantor wants to emigrate and come ashore. Penalties with respect to foreign non-grantor trust is if the trust accumulates income and then distributes the income. Under almost a punitive system, that income is subject to throwback and interest under Section 668. If accumulated capital gains are going to be distributed, then the law converts them to tax as ordinary income. If you have U.S. beneficiaries, it may be of advantage for the non-resident alien to create a U.S. trust, except you have to be sure that the U.S. beneficiaries do not have the kinds of powers under the document that would make the trust property taxable to them. As to choice of U.S. jurisdictions for these foreign trusts to be administered, almost the same kind of considerations as a U.S. person would take in choosing a U.S. and choosing a jurisdiction here. You want to pick a jurisdiction with hospitable trust legislation. Since this panel is being sponsored by our good friends from Wilmington, Delaware is certainly one of those. Also, you want to pick one where there are no local taxes. Delaware also qualifies there. And one with a very forgiving or non-existent rule against perpetuities to allow the non-resident alien to avoid generation skipping tax. And that, of course, would also include our friends from Wilmington.
I think, Norm, that all those tests you just ticked off, also you could say Florida, you know, we have no taxes on trust with the repeal of the intangible tax, which you never had to pay anyway if you did any planning for it. We don't have a non-existent, we've got a very forgiving rule against perpetuities of 306 years. Most of my clients think 306 years is enough. And also, Wilmington Trust also has offices here in Florida.
Mr. Corin, I better move on here. Mr. Corin, are you recommending trust to your clients? And why? Does the size of the estate matter? Along the same lines, are your clients interested in protecting gifts and inheritances from their children's creditors and future spouses? If so, what do you recommend to provide that protection?
Well, to quote our last president, depends on the meaning of is. What kind of trust? I've already talked about the fact that in doing asset shifting, a lot of those techniques involve various forms of trust. From a revocable trust standpoint, I'm probably in the minority here, but I don't automatically use those. I would say we probably use them about 70% of the time. I think younger clients and the smaller estates, I don't necessarily feel that the trade-offs, depending upon the particular situation, unless there's a reason, again, for having something in, are we concerned about incapacity or the like. But as the numbers go up, I think that we probably move closer to 100% that are. If you're certainly above 100 million, I don't think I have anybody that's not in a revocable trust. We obviously also use testamentary trusts all the time. Increasingly, what I'm finding, and it ties to the second half of your question, is that trying to talk to clients about one thing that you can do that at least in Florida your child can't do for themselves is to give them asset protection. Not many people are that concerned about that. Some are if they're in high-risk areas or they've been sued a lot, but otherwise they don't seem to be. But, boy, you talk about a former spouse, and you can say, well, we can deal with that by leaving it in and giving each generation the ability to change it for the next generation, but not for themselves. And so we're having a lot of use of the 360. And I agree with Bruce. The way I used it when we were debating about the repeal, I was opposed to the repeal totally, but we came up with this. I said, well, you know, George Washington's daddy could have created a trust that just now would be coming close to having to expire. That's a long time. And so 360 is probably enough. So we use a lot of dynasty trusts, a lot more than we had been using in the past. And a lot of it is driven by divorce. You get into all the circumstances of how fractious it can be with the various contested divorces. And if you can get those assets so that they're not on the table, that's a lot better, and it appeals to clients a lot. One of the things that I have a fair number of clients who are not Florida residents, and so I'm having to become a lot more familiar with state income taxes, fortunately not personally. Well, actually, even personally, the way we've been promised we're going to change it this year, but I actually paid, I guess, 6% in state income taxes because of the way our partnership agreement set up, and that worked out that that's about how it got allocated, or 5%, I guess it was. If you've got a client out of, you know, in a state that has an income tax, we're finding the use of creating a non-grantor asset protection trust as a way to avoid the state income tax. And if you talk about a state, say Georgia, and you say, well, it's 6%. Well, you know, it's 6% compared to 15% federal. That's a 40% increase. And that's a big number. I got to meet Jeff today, who I've worked with a lot on putting together some asset protection non-grantor trust for clients to move the assets to Delaware so that they don't have to pay the state income tax, and they also have all the benefits of asset protection. We tend to do a fair amount of prenuptial agreements.
Just toss in, as hopefully everybody here knows, we have the new Florida Trust Code becoming effective on July the 1st of this year, and we've always had very good spendthrift law in Florida, and in drafting the new Florida Trust Code, we were very careful to preserve that and not to change it. It's been codified now. It was before, it was not, it was only by case law, but it's been codified. We were very acutely conscious. We did not want to mess with spendthrift laws. And I agree with Ed. I've seen almost a total shift in my drafting over the last 10 years. In my early career, it was almost invariably paying out to children at certain ages. You know, you plug in the age all at 25 or 25, 30, 35. Amazing how many documents I've drawn over the years where my clients miraculously concluded 25, 30, and 35. was the right age because my form said that. But it's almost totally shifted. In fact, my default provision now is there are no more distributions outright at any age. It remains in trust for the child's life. And then the balance, the drafting and the planning process shifts towards control of the assets, the ability to control who the trustees are, to direct trustees if you can, to remove and replace trustees. So it then shifts to provide asset protection. But it's still fully available under the new Florida Trust Code.
Predator protection is probably the primary selling point we have for trusts, because even with the popularity, at least in terms of publications, you read about asset protection, there is nothing as bulletproof as you can do for your family in terms of asset protection as creating a good lifetime discretionary trust. Some clients, although they're fewer and fewer, parade horribles when you bring up the subject about trust management, how personnel changes in the trust institutions and the rapid turnover. You never get to know the person who's running your trust. To those people, I have a new story to tell them. And actually, the Wall Street Journal told it first on Friday. If you have a copy around, look in the journal of the story about the good diet doctor Atkins estate. While he did go through, I guess, the exercise of providing for a trust, he apparently did not take enough care on the issue of the selection of the trustees.
When I was still a partner with Ed at Holland & Knight, and when we had a mammoth six-day drafting session to modernize our forms and to get into document assembly system, we sequestered ourselves for 6 days, working 12 to 14 hours a day, true story, over going from A to Z in every form that we had. And
that was our alternative ski week. It was in January.
And maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I guess I was surprised at the time. The most difficult provision we had of all of drafting anything was the trustee article, the trustee selection, trustee governance article. Everything else is pretty rationally driven, you know, all the formulas and so forth. That was far and away the most complicated of anything. And I think that's the most critical thing most of us in drafting now.
Thank you. Now we're to your favorite part of the program, what they call on Car Talk, stump the chumps. Vicki will be coming up to take a question or two.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi, I'm Carol Crock. I'm from Wilmington Trust. And thank you all. This is extremely interesting. Everyone talked a lot about grantor trusts and use of them. And I'm curious, what's your favorite technique for getting grantor trust treatment? And I guess I'll call on Ed.
Well, it depends on what we're trying to do. If it's a grant, I put everything in there. Substitution of assets, power of someone to name additional beneficiaries, dealing with borrowing of assets, paying insurance premiums. I want to cover the waterfront. If it's a circumstance where it's going to be a sale to a defective trust or it's the receptacle trust that we sometimes would use coming out of the grant where we also make that a grantor trust, I have more concerns about given some case law on substitution and some of the other areas, but having the ability to add to beneficiaries, someone in a non-fiduciary capacity to, or the trustee to add that is probably the best.
Let me just take a real quick stab at that. I used to use the 675 for substitution powers a lot. I don't use them very much anymore, except in some cases like Ed, where I'll throw in the kitchen sink. But if it's going to be a longer-term trust, I've gotten very scared of those because I think they could very well wind up with estate tax inclusion despite the Jordahl case. Just one really quick example. Suppose that I'm going to transfer. I'm Bill Gates. I'm going to transfer a huge block or sell a huge block of Microsoft stock into this defective trust. I'm going to retain the right to purchase it back by paying full fair market value. If I told you guys, as I wished had been the case while driving up here today, that Bill Gates called me on the phone and said, Bruce, I'm going to give you the right to buy all of my stock in Microsoft. You're going to have to pay for it, but I'm going to give you that right. Don't you think that right is worth something? I can go out, I can market that right. I can go to Wall Street. I can form a syndicate and I can get money for the right to do that. And if I've transferred that asset in and have retained that right, I've retained something of value. So those have scared me. I always now use a non-fiduciary person, not the trustee, somebody other than the trustee having the power to add beneficiaries, to add charitable beneficiaries. The reason I don't use a trustee is because there may come a time when I've got that client who says, ouch, this thing is too painful. I'm paying too much in income taxes. Let's switch this baby off. I don't want it to be a grantor trust anymore. Would it not be a per se breach of fiduciary duty by the trustee to say all of a sudden, all right, beneficiaries, we're going to start paying tax out of this trust, and this person who's the settlor, not a beneficiary, you know, we're going to take the tax burden off his back, and we're just going to pay the taxes going forward. I wouldn't want to be the trustee to do that. So I give that power to somebody acting in a non-fiduciary capacity. Sometimes it's me. I try to avoid being named in documents if possible, but where I can do that and I'm exonerated from any type of duty, I can, you know, the grantor calls me and says, I don't want to pay taxes anymore. Boom, switches off.
We tend to use some or all of those powers. And again, depending on the context, a few words of warning is where you have a power to substitute assets. While I'm not as concerned that unless by legislation, they will make that power subject to estate tax, in which event?
There have been rumors of a pending reg project on that for a year or so, but nothing's come out on it.
In which event, if you have the power, there should be a power to release it, that we accept from the power of substitution life insurance assets and Section 2036B controlled corporate stock. On the power to add beneficiaries, we exclude the class of well, first of all, we define carefully the class of beneficiaries that may be added, and we, again, give the person holding the power to release it, and we also attempt to exclude the kinds of people who may hold this power. Let's say you call this person a selector or a protector or whatever who gets to add beneficiaries. you usually want to provide for some kind of successorship in that person so that there's always somebody around who can do this. But we make sure that we exclude from the class of people who can exercise this power, obviously the settlor and the settlor's wife, anybody who's a beneficiary. We also exclude related and subordinate parties to the settlor, and we also exclude any person who is in the class that could be added, but may not at present be added to the class of beneficiaries.
One final point on that is that because of all these things, say, oh, well, things may change whenever. Increasingly, what we are building into the trust are effectively decanting provisions so that you can say, well, you know, this doesn't treat what we want to do anymore, so let's pour it over to a new trust that's created by the grantor for essentially one or more of the same benefits.
Well, our forward-looking members of the Florida Bar Real Property Probate and Trust Section apparently with a statute that even if you don't have a special power in your document that permits decanting, that will provide.
You've got the old 1940, I think, Phipps case, which we've had it all along here. Most people didn't know about it, but we do have this in the legislation, and I haven't gotten an update on it, but it did pass the House, and it's over in the Senate. It's non-controversial, and it should pass. As a matter of fact, it's something that's it's been put into the bill that's going through by the Florida Bankers Association. It's real property probate and trust law sponsored legislation, and Norm's partner, Diana Zadel, was the driving force behind this. She drafted most of it, and she's owed a lot of credit for the work she did on that. But that should become effective, and it should become effective very soon when it passes and the governor signs it or lets it become law, because I think it becomes effective on becoming law, yes. And it's retroactive.
Thank you, panelists. Thank all of you for coming. Hope you enjoyed it.
This recording of the Future Vision of Estate Planning is copyrighted by Wilmington Trust Corporation and used with Wilmington Trust's permission. Further reproduction without permission is prohibited. Lineberg Information Services, Inc., Lizzie, is deeply appreciative and would like to particularly thank Dick Neno, Managing Director and Trust Counsel at Wilmington Trust, for allowing Lizzie to record and share this most important seminar.